Blog Talk Radio.
Incarceration and recidivism. This is our first season in this particular program. It is brought to you by Tribe Family Channel, a Gumbo for the Soul International Family brand. The executive producer is Beverly Black. The co-producer is Diane Sears, and I am your guest moderator, Maxine Bryan. I am a criminal justice professor at the Georgia Southern University Armstrong campus. Again, welcome. We've been experiencing some technical difficulties, and so I'm not sure if my guests are on the line, but let me tell you who we are expecting to join us real soon. Have you ever heard of Tougaloo 9? That's a group of people, it was 9 students, back in 1961, who went to Tougaloo College. And they staged a sit-in in a public library that was designed just for white people. And, of course, they were put out. Now, one of our guests is a woman by the name of Geraldine Edwards Hollis. Now, she went to go check out a book, but she had done her homework, and she knew that the only place to get that book was at the library they were at. Of course, they were denied service. Police were called. One of the things that I think is remarkable about this whole incident is, one, that they did stage the sit-in, these young college students who dared to go against the establishment for what was a basic civil right, the right to read in a public setting. But more than that was the violence that came after the sit-in. They were arrested. They were put in jail for over 30 hours in dark cells. They were interrogated separately without the counsel of attorneys, without their parents being there. But there was a lot of violence that erupted after that. Police dogs were called and put up on protesters. But it was a time when the nation, many African Americans across the country, came together in support of the Tougaloo Nine. So we are excited to be able to talk to Ms. Geraldine Hollis. Another one of our guests who's going to be joining us today is Dr. Amina Ali. I'm excited about her. She has an initiative that's called Healing and Repatriation. Now, It really talks about returning to an original land or returning an asset or something of value to the owner. And so we're going to be talking to her about how that word fits in with the notion of incarcerated people, particularly men who are often parents when they go in and may be paying child support or may be behind. But if they have children and there's a child support order against them, that order continues while they are incarcerated. It does not go away. And some of her efforts are in alignment with trying to get that turned around. I'm excited about that because in the work that I do, a lot of times I hear that particular complaint. And I know in Indiana we had begun to work with the child support office to begin to address that issue because it's quite unfair for child support arrearage to continue to accrue while a person cannot work. They are incarcerated. Then when they get out, one of the first things their probation or parole officer says is, get a job, and you got to pay your fees while you're on probation or parole. If you have court-ordered substance drops, urine drops, then you got to pay for that. If you have court-ordered treatment, anger management, counseling, and whatever that is, you got to pay for that. And then on top of it, if you have a child and there is a child support order, you have to pay for that too. Well, at Incarcerated Lives Matter, our goal is to educate the general public about all of the barriers that exist for people with criminal histories, for people who are being released from our prisons. And you do know that although the United States holds only about 5% of the world's population, we have over 25% of the world's incarcerated people. A lot of that is due to our war on drugs that we had in our country, and our current administration wants to bring that war back, and it's not that it ever left, but they want to really reinvigorate it, if you will. So, and we know that the majority of people who were caught up in that war were black and brown people. But this show is dedicated to bringing to the forefront the issues and the barriers that face people with criminal history. So I understand that our guests are on the line, so let me introduce to you first Geraldine Hollis, one of the Tougaloo Nine. Ms. Hollis, how are you?
Thank you very much. I am just great. I appreciate being here to be able to have a word or two on your program and also just the opportunity to listen and see what is going on with incarceration, because incarceration does matter.
Absolutely, it does. And we appreciate what you and your eight other cohorts did back in 1961. And I understand that there were actually more people involved, but they were the lookouts. And so their lives were on the line too, correct?
Oh, yes. Yeah. They were not arrested because they did not go into the library. But because of their efforts, it made things better for us, those who went into the library.
Right.
Yes.
Right. We're going to talk more about that and have some other questions, particularly for you, as it relates to the outcome or the implications for us now,
yes,
in 2018 as a result of systemic racism that existed then and the institutionalized racism that we see in many of our areas across our country now. Let me move to Dr. Ali. Dr. Ali, how are you?
I am well. Thank you so very much for having me on your show.
Well, I am honored to have you on the show. You are doing some wonderful things for people who are being released, particularly those men who find themselves caught up in the criminal justice system. One of your initiatives is healing and repatriation. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, we started off, first of all, with people that were undocumented in this country, and they were coming in and they were finding themselves on the wrong end of the criminal justice system. And now they're undocumented and they're being made to give a greater return on the investment of society. And because we were researching some terms for their welfare, I found some loopholes in the Child Support and Enforcement Office policy and procedures. Now, the protocol calls for the absentee parent, whether it be father or mother, of course, now with 90% being the father, it is required that they pay child support up to the child's 18th birthday. And it is said up to 21 if they're in college. But it never stipulates how often they are to pay. It is only the rules, rights, and regulations of the Child Support Enforcement Office. That's why it's enforcement instead of Child Support Collection or Child Support Remittance Office. Is because that office was created to enforce the effort of getting money to the parents. However, in the interim, they also set up programs like TANF. And TANF, of course, is Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. And this is money that is being paid until, quote, unquote, they find the father gets a job, or they can initiate some payments. So we're saying, well, why is it that it's okay for them, the parents, the custodial parents, to receive TANF? And the father being absent, he doesn't have a bill, yet as soon as they find him, the clock starts. So now we're saying, if the clock is starting now and they're incarcerated, or you find out they're incarcerated or they're unemployed, why is it now a penalty to pay it when the mother is getting assistance to help the child? So the initiative came about because we need to redefine what it is that they are saying and doing to us, because it's two different languages that they're speaking. The language that they're saying to us is that if you don't pay, you're going to jail. But the language that is there and in existence from way back in the 50s and 60s when this started was that you have until their 18th birthday to make remittance. So I started this initiative because I wanted the men to understand their rights, not what is being told to them. And I wanted them to understand that they have until then. And when we get further into the program, I'll help you to understand the program that we're putting out as alternative to get back that recompense that they are deserving in time and talent so that they can pay for their child and then be a valued asset to society.
Okay, great, great. Thank you. So
you're most welcome.
Dig right on in. This is the ending of Black History Month, and there have been lots of conversations, events, programs, and whatnot that shed light on the injustices and the discriminatory efforts made against Black and brown people, actually. But what I want to start off with, particularly as it relates to incarcerated persons, is a broad question. It's kind of like, how did we get here? How did we get here to a time where we have a nation that has out of control mass incarceration, and the significant number of those people who are incarcerated are African American and then Hispanic and then white? How did we get here? Like Ms. Hollis, to start back, because to start this part of the conversation, because you lived in a period of time where the ball was really rolling forward as it relates to very obvious types of discriminatory action towards Black people. And you might be able then to shed some light in terms of how the climate of that day has impacted us to today in 2018?
Well, thank you very much. Really, going back, we know that it was not just systemic incarceration or racism. It was a way of life. In the South, we knew that we had injustice. We knew that there was discrimination. And we knew that there was second-class citizenship. One of the main things that was always thrown to the citizenry of my town and the area was that if you don't do this, you're going to go to jail. If you don't do that, you're going to go to jail. Jail was always used as the height of what could be done to you if you did not comply, if you didn't do some of the normal day things. And I tell people all of the time, even walking on the sidewalk or being disrespectful or not even speaking, all of those things would have been a way of getting you to jail or to be interrogated or to be held for suspicion or any of those things. So we lived under those conditions. And one of the main things that actually the people of the time tried not to do was to let people go to jail, because we knew that jail was just the second way of going for slavery. And the same way it is now. If you went to jail, that meant that you were working on the chain gangs. And you could go to jail for anything, and you would have to go out and work on the chain gangs. So that was a way of life, and we didn't like it. It wasn't what we would approve of, but it was something that we knew was wrong. And I shared with another group in speaking that I always read. I always had to get information. I was always looking to see what I could see or do that was better in my life. So growing up, I knew that I didn't like these things, and I knew that I wanted to get around these things. So the main thing for me was learning and trying to make my life so that I could get out of that situation, not to escape the area, because I know that this is where my family and all of us lived, but to see how we could make it better. So this is my goal all along, just growing up as a youngster, because I didn't always buy into the fact that I had to do everything, but I knew that I had to do some things in order to save myself from being in those injustices, even when it came to learning. If I had to learn something, that meant that I had to work a lot harder. If I had a textbook that was already written up and probably 4 years old with the names of other students in it, that meant that I had to go and look for something different. One of the things that I know that helped me was when I did get to a school that was new and they had a library. And I went into the library, and with another friend of mine, we just ate up everything. And I mean, ate up mean read up everything that we could to learn what was happening in the world. We didn't have all of the access that we have now, but we did have some of the books and things. And so learning about life. Now, as far as the lifestyle, I tell everyone, we had a wonderful life because it was communal. It was community involved. What was shared was that everyone shared. But there were some things you just could not share to help people. I had a cousin, as far as being incarcerated. He was a young man when he was incarcerated, about the same age as my dad. And my dad, I knew my dad, I got to know him and his family when he was still a young man. And this young man was said to have whistled at a white girl in this small town. He was put in jail, and he didn't get out for almost 50 years.
50 years?
Yes. When he got out of prison, and it was when I was almost about 20 years ago that when he got out. And at that time, I was in my 50s. Mm. So that's when he got out of prison. And this was not just jail, this was prison. And that's all that he had done. But he had been involved in the incarcerated life so much and so long that he didn't know how to live outside.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the way of living. That was a way of getting people to man those fields, those highways, those things
mm-hmm.
that was done during those areas. So jail was something that we knew we didn't want to go to. And during those years, you just knew you didn't want to do anything that would put you in jail because you knew that more than likely you would not get out. Once you get in that system, it just was hard to get out of it because they wouldn't just take you to jail. They would send you on to prison. And I'm sure over the news and everything.
Wow. Wow.
People knew about some of those prisons.
This month, as I said, I've been involved in several conversations, presentations, and all of that around our history and the traumatic history of African Americans, in particular in the United States of America. And similar stories to what you just shared have been, you know, highlighted over this past month, particularly in the South. And I'm not from the South. Some of the stories we knew up north that we'd heard stories that things were happening in the South, but it wasn't like in your face. And so now I'm meeting people such as yourself who lived this experience. And let me ask you this before I go to Dr. Ali. One of the things that came out in a conversation or event as a film showing, actually, that I was at last night about lynchings in the South, and the comment from one of the scholars was that all of that oppression that you all experience and the threat of jail and prison created a traumatized community, and that impacted your behavior either to get in line so that you weren't accused of being disobedient, or it perpetuated lawlessness. And again, you were, you know, a part of that in terms of what was considered lawlessness in that at that time. And the speaker went on to say that that yet impacts lawlessness that we see among our young people even now, although it's not for just cause. Your lawlessness was for just cause. But they were saying there's a connection between the experiencing, you know, of our ancestors, grandparents, great-grandparents, and all of that, that type of experience and how it either parlayed into lawfulness, you're going to abide, and what looks now in my mind for a long time when I moved here to be apathy, or lawlessness, which is what you did. Do you agree that that lawlessness route can plays a factor into the behavior of our youth today when they're doing things that are like antisocial?
You know, I can agree with you in some ways, and, it goes both ways.
Mm-hmm.
It's created a mentality of I'm going to overcome this, where people really geared up and knew that they were going to get past all of this degradation.
Mm.
And that meant that we grew stronger in our reserve. To overcome. That's why so many people in the South went to colleges. That's why so many people in the South went out from the area so that they could learn how to do things better or to be able to have a better life. Now, there is a notion that I hear you saying where young people revolted in a way because they started doing all of the things that were derogatory towards those things. I'm not going to listen to this. I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to be a part of this. And they did this in ways that actually they were not the negative, but they were positive because that's how we got started with the things that are coming up now. That's how we got started with some of the new way of the music, the new wave of music, the new ways of dancing. So black people started doing things that showed that they had a way of doing things that was not in regard to what was the norm. And so those things grew into a whole new pattern of living for a lot of younger people. I'm not going to just address all of the things specifically, but we know that there was a change in things. There was, it came along with the evolving into the hip-hop and all of these kinds of things that eventually people were saying things and doing things. And so all of that made a difference in the way that people were looking that they're going to do and live their lives accordingly. Now, basically, I do believe that it's documented that we probably have more people that are getting higher degrees of education in the South than in most areas, because even when I came to California, those of us who came during those times, all of us came from the South. We were educated in the South, and I met so many people when I did move to California, and that was in the late 60s, that the majority of the people that left the South and came to the West, and I'm talking about the things that I know of, mostly came with the degrees and everything so that they didn't have any problems in becoming teachers in the West.
Okay.
And as far as mentoring, modeling and mentoring, I think that the community itself in the South made a big difference. The churches and the people, especially the, I tell a lot of people that one of the reasons why I was so well groomed in my education is that because the teachers who got degrees and became professors, they couldn't work in many of the colleges and universities in the South. So that meant that they settled to teach at the high schools. Our high school teachers were just phenomenal, just phenomenal.
Okay.
So that helped us. That gave us the impetus to move forward in our lives because we saw what they were doing. And we saw how that they made a difference in the lives of the neighborhood, the community, and the children.
And that's a whole nother topic. The and I'm not going to get into it now, but the topic or the thought that integration of our schools took away that that community. Communal education, where you had top-level black educators teaching students, black students. And then with integration and busing, young children were taken out of their neighborhoods into other neighborhoods and were taught by white people who didn't understand the culture and all of that. So, but that's another topic. But thank you for that insight. Thank you very much. Dr. Ali, we're getting ready to break for commercial, but when we come back, I really want to get into the word that you use, repatriation, and how that translates for those young men who are largely young men who are incarcerated and having the responsibility, the onus of being of their child support accruing while they are yet incarcerated, and how unfair that is and what's being done about it. But for right now, we're going to stop for commercial break, and we'll be right back.
The Dr. Maxine Bryant Show. Tune in, www.blogtalkradio.com, Gumbo for the Soul, to listen to the lively conversations that are relevant, dynamic, and inspiring. On the Dr. Maxine Bryan Show, the first segment, Groove Talk, is dedicated to uplifting listeners and engaging them in life-changing conversations that can help move them forward with their weekly tasks. The second segment, When Is My Debt Paid?, focuses on challenges and successes of released prisoners as they reintegrate into society. The Dr. Maxine Bryant Show.
Okay, Okay, Dr. Ali. So,
yes, ma'am. I am here.
How and why did you choose that word for your initiative, you know, in the whole phrase, healing and repatriation? How did you come to choose those two words together?
I didn't. It chose me. So in all honesty.
Okay.
In all honesty, I can't take the credit. It was given to me while I was planning the program. But the definition of repatriation is sending money back to one's own country or returning that person. And what I wanted to do is get the mindset, not necessarily the action per se. Of course, the sending the money back is always the key into this program because it's the money that's involved. But it's really understanding where the person is coming from in the country in which they are established in. It's kind of like bloom where you're planted. So it's the understanding of bringing that person back to who they are so that they can bloom wherever they are. So their country will now become their mindset rather than a geographical site. So when you brought in the point about how did we get here, that was phenomenal because that's where my research came from. That's exactly where how did we get here? How did we get to the point where, you know, you can't even support your child even if you wanted to based on the rules that's in place, you know?
Okay.
And to answer that is I'm telling you, it's a whole nother dissertation and and I never want to challenge another one again ever.
But I love it.
I'm telling you, but you know, slavery was abolished in 1865, and with the Civil War and the passing of the 13th Amendment, there was a racial caste system that was developed in the United States. That caste system should have ended at the passage of that amendment. However, the idea of race as a marker continued, the marker as in where are we as a people. After Reconstruction, the majority of whites during that time believed that newly freed African Americans were too lazy. They were incompetent. They couldn't read and write because they didn't allow us to read and write, which made the legislature pass Black Codes. I know you remember that term.
Mm-hmm.
And the Black Code
was
essentially a system of white control. You know, that's it. And these codes pretty much varied from state to state, but they were rooted from slavery and they foreshadowed the Jim Crow laws. For example, employment was required for all freed men, and violators faced vagrancy charges, and they were not taught to read and write, so them not being able to get a job was pretty much forced because of their illiteracy. Now, just like now, they're being forced to get a job, same thing, and now because of their criminal record, they're being held back again. So this code is still being enforced.
Yes.
However, the plantation systems back then expanded, especially tobacco and cotton, and the demand for forced labor and land severance increased. Now, they weren't giving us 40 acres and a mule. However, they're wanting us to till these lands. They're wanting us to get into this thing of going back to work. So what did they up? Indentured servitude. And that's when they said they were going to pay you. They gave you a little something. They may have given you a house or a piece of land. And some of us kept it in our family. Some of us got rid of it. But none of us kept the integrity of that mindset of getting your own. And I say that not to belittle anyone, but because of the rules that were in place, rules like what are in place today, I'm going to hold you captive in a place where it really doesn't help you. And then when I release you, I'm going to release you into the fold and tell you to now function the way we do with the education and the resources we have. So it's a white mindset that they're placing African American, I say Black and brown, brothers and sisters in. Now, fast forward to the child support initiative. Now, you're telling me now that since slavery, when you were taking us from our wives and our husbands and you were separating our family, you were breeding our women to have Mandingo men so that you can breed them out, and you were second classing the children for the sake of the parent, and you were making them indentured servants as they got older, the family never unified. The very essence of where the family reunion comes from is because slave men, now free, went to each of these lands and brought their children together. That's why we have family reunions today, and we always go to the country or we always go to a piece of land. It's because they were going to each of the lands and they were giving directions for the wives and the children in that area, of course, because he was taken from that and sold many times. So he went back and got his children, and he reunited the brothers and sisters and the wives so that they could have that bond in that. And that is not being seen now as to how we can bring that premise back. We are not being allowed to have that family unit for the sake of race and that class and now the black code.
Right.
So with all of those strikes against us, my research formulated the need for us to have a bigger piece of that pie. And I read Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow, and that was a great piece that helped us to understand what the country is coming to and how the formation of finance and all that is coming and how that's going to be a better asset for their communities but not ours and how we need to get in there and educate and inform.
Yes.
And that led me to understand the final concept, which is how to put that together so that we benefit. And one of the pieces that I have is something that is in their new codes called the 529 prepaid college fund. And if you Google that, 529 prepaid college fund, that is a subsidy that you can put away up to 21 years, therein lies that code, that you can set aside money for that child. Now, TANF is in place to take care of the temporary assistance for needy families. That's the money that's put aside so that when women say, I need to get food stamps and health insurance, I can now go to the government and say, look, I have a child, I need some help, and they're going to say, where's the absentee father? You know, most of the women don't want to get the man in trouble. I don't know, so now it makes the government have to go out and look for him. In the meantime, they say, here's some money every month. That money is good until that child's 18th birthday. They don't tell you that. They try to push you off again, push you off the welfare system, and they try to get you off of that. But if you understand that children can get insurance until they're 18 and then they can get food stamps until they're 18, then the system knows that it will keep that child on the system until they're 18. Now, the father's incarcerated for 5 years, 6 years, 8 years, 10 years. He has to come out and now reacclimate himself to society, get up to par with the new technology, get a cell phone for that matter, because some of them have been incarcerated before cell phones. So now he has to reintegrate himself into society, so getting a job is not going to be as fast and as efficient. So what does that mean? That means whatever little bit of money he has above the table or under the table has to be put away. The state is not saying, you need to find some money and you need to give it to us so we can pay this child support. It's not paying child support. You're actually, that money that goes into the child support office pays the state back for giving the mother food support. So it's not paying to the child. Please let's be clear with that. It is
good
not
point.
Giving anything to the child. So what I'm saying is, since you're holding the money anyway, let's hold it in a fund so that the child actually benefits. So let's set up this 529 fund as soon as the father is able and ready, and actually his family can set this up for him so he is looking like he is actually paying those bills, and the grandmother can do it, the mother, the godmother can do it, even a older sibling, an uncle, a cousin, a nephew can do it. Set it up with the father's name, Social Security number, giving the benefits and beneficiaries to the children and their Social Security numbers, not the mother. That's the key thing. And I'm not taking anything away from the mother, but I don't want that to be an accessible
thing,
a finance, and the child lose the benefit. So the child's name is on it, the father's name is on it, whoever opened the account's name is on it as the beneficiary, as the custodial account holder. And then as every month comes in, the father can say to the family, the father's incarcerated, they could say to the family, okay, you're sending me $100 every month, send me $75, put $25 in the account. And every month that $25 goes in there and interest is accruing. At the end of 18 years, 21 years even, depending on where the child is, that child now has enough money with the interest accrued, and this is just on $25, maybe $50 at the most, has enough money in 18 years to go to a state-funded school for 4 years. Now, if you do the math in your head, it doesn't round out as much, but what they do in the 529 is when it's time to cash out, the state matches the funds. So if you have enough 2 years, the state now gives you 2 years because it's a state-mandated program and they have to match the funds. It's like the old 401K when they used to match funds. You put a certain amount in there. At the maturity date, the government or the employer would match those funds. This program is still the same. They don't tell you that loophole until the end because they want you to pull out. They want you to pull out a lot of money so that they don't have to pay as much money. So they won't tell you that loophole. So I said, okay, well, let me teach and inform, which is my duty now to the generations that's coming up.
Yeah.
You now have the option to now put this money away so that TANF or the state is helping the mother now. And what greater joy that all these men can say is that I paid for my child's college.
Yes. Awesome.
Those brothers, when I introduced it to them, I had half this hardcore, resilient, these men that are, you know, I'll kill you before I look at you wrong. And these men were in tears to know that even behind bars, they can support their child's college education. They can say, I did that. The state can't take that from them because they put that money away. They can't touch
right.
it for taxation. They cannot employ them to use that in any kind of giving it back to the child support enforcement because it is a program in force. And that's why I needed to bring it to legislature, because they needed to have that as a part of the now child support program and protocol. And that's what we're fighting now in Congress.
Awesome, awesome. Now, you mentioned a word that I want to go back to. I mean, you said so much that I want to continue to talk about, but I want to go back to that word caste. You mentioned that.
Yes, it's
and,
a racial caste, not cultural.
Yes, and Ms. Hollis, you lived it,
mm-hmm.
and Ms. Ali, you studied it.
Yeah, I'm 50, so I haven't lived it, no. I didn't live it. I just grew up in it. I grew up in it.
Yeah, and we did. We grew up in it to a degree. I think Ms. Hollis
yes.
definitely was in the throes of it.
Oh,
and
she made the history of it. She was making the history
yes.
of it. I was just learning
absolutely.
About it in school. But yeah.
Absolutely. So I want to talk about that word for a minute, because we're not, even though we don't call it that, I agree with you, Dr. Ali, that Michelle Alexander correctly uses that to describe where we are now, particularly with our,
yes.
Our incarceration system.
Yes.
But,
yes.
Ms. Hollis, when you were younger and you all were having to fight for everything or give in, you know, and say, I'm not, you know, and be afraid to walk down the street lest you may rush up against someone or be falsely accused of whistling or whatever. What was that like? How did that, what impact did that have on you
mm-hmm.
and your peers at that time? Did you even know that you were in a caste system?
Yes, we didn't know that it was called a caste system. However, we knew that we had these reservations.
Mm-hmm.
I did allude to the fact that in communities, when I was just a young girl, and I can best answer this by telling you just a part of the story. My granddad was the foreman that worked with the sharecroppers and the people who worked in the fields. So he owned his own land. He never did sharecrop. And so that gave us a different idea about how we could live. But the other of his brothers lived down a lane that all of them lived in houses that were provided by the crop owners, the owners of the property that let them use the land to sharecrop. And so I grew up with things that my other cousins didn't have. And we lived outside of the community, not outside, but further north than they were. And my granddad had three parcels of land, and he had his own animals and things like that. He had his home and a garden in the back and a fruit orchard, small fruit orchard on the side. So we lived in that area, but the way that the town was made, all of the people who were not like us, who were white, they lived in the area around the town. If you drew a circle, this the outer part of the circle, all around the outer parts, on the north and the south were where the blacks lived. But on the west side, that was where the plantations were, and that's where the family that did the sharecropping was. They were all over on that side. So you knew that there were different areas that you lived in, but you still knew that you didn't live within that nuclei of being where everything was, where the sidewalks were. We had to pass from gravel roads to a sidewalk area. and we had to go through the town and cross the highway to get to the south part in order to go to school. So you knew that there were differences. And I had to pass by a couple of schools before I could get to the school that I live in. So regardless of what you call it, you knew that you were on the outside of the nuclei of what the life was. And so that was a part of our bringing up. But living in those areas, we also had the nurturing of the communities, the neighbors. I tell people all of the time that you never went hungry, not really, really hungry. I don't remember if they had anything like no food stamps or anything like that. They might have had some commodities at some times, but when I was really living in that area, there was no commodities. But people would bring food to you and share with you if you had a large family. There is a plant that's called a kusha. A kusha was something that was just everything for a family. You could fry it, boil it, bake it, whatever, and you could make it into a vegetable or a sweet, whatever. So there was no way that you could really starve if you had a kusha and some beans and rice and things like that. So we knew that there was all of these things around us. We knew that there was an environmental difference, but the nurturing of that community meant that people worked together, supported each other. And the church was one of the catalysts of how our days and weeks went, because that was always a place that we could go together and to have mended spirits and things. But I just wanted to bring that story in to let you know that I lived with my grandparents, and I knew that we were doing something different than the rest of the people. We had something that others didn't have, and we weren't the only ones. But those people on that north side owned the land. Those on the west side, they were more like renters, but they didn't rent. They just farmed the lands of the landowners, and that meant that they had to be whatever they wanted them to do. And many of them, it's just like the books you read now, they would work all year long and they never could get out of debt.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time that I was a teenager, that landowners wanted to sell that land for to build more homes and things. So that meant that all of those people were kicked off of that land. And I don't mean kicked, but they didn't have a place to live.
Right.
So it was people like my granddad and my family who would break up their land and sold the lots to the family members. So we ended up with maybe five different families living right on in the block where my granddad had his land. So there was a difference, but it was not so much as the choices that people made, but the knowledge of knowing what was what. Because his brothers knew the same thing that he knew, but they chose to be in that area and to be able to be the sharecroppers. They didn't buy land. So that made a big difference. Those who knew and desired to do better did better. Those who didn't, they didn't do better. So I tell young people when I talk to them today, everybody has choices, but sometimes you have to give up the things you want to get the things that you need.
Mm-hmm. This is true. This is true. So you mentioned two things that I want to use to transition into Dr. Ali's focal point. One, you mentioned that even though there was a lack and you were aware of a caste system, may not have known it was that, but what a redeeming factor was that there was nurturing, right, among the community. Dr. Ali, we find that that is missing for those caught up in our current day caste system called mass incarceration. There is very little nurturing, if at all. Let's talk about that for a little bit, the fact that society places a stigma on deadbeat dads and men who are incarcerated and are not paying their child support. There is very little understanding. So what you're doing, one, is trying to not only educate the men, but bring up to the forefront for the masses to understand this deep hole that society is helping them to dig themselves into. So can you talk about that for a moment?
Of course, of course. Bringing in the topic we talked about a few minutes ago about why we had the family reunions, this brings up a very tentative point in this, and I'm going to bring that in about 2 seconds. I remember when I was researching about why we have family reunions and why do people of color go to family reunions, what started all that? At first, I thought it was just a reason just to meet all the cousins that you didn't know. But there was history to that. And, of course, when the men were sold to different plantations, they befriended and wed each of the women. One of the reasons why our marriages weren't validated is because we were taken from one wife and given to another woman whom we married, who we kept it sacred. So we married the women. But because the men were able to marry so many different women, or was forced to marry so many different women because they went from Louisiana to Alabama to Georgia in the slave trade, is because there was a need for them to have a role in this juncture. In order for them to have continuous slaves, the stud had to go and sire quite a few of these babies, and they got the healthiest women and the healthiest men together to have the healthiest babies so that they can continue the slavery population. The unfortunate piece about that was that the ancestry of our people got greater. So instead of them thinking that they were doing something to benefit their bottom line, they were strengthening our families. So now instead of saying I have a family in Mississippi, I got one in Alabama, I got one in Louisiana, I went as far as Texas, and I got a couple kids over there. So when he made that reunion, now this one man now had 12, 13, 14 children. And you know the midwife in me is going to reiterate the fact that all of them were born at home, because, you remember, we couldn't go to the hospital. We were too dirty. Right. Our skin color was going to rub off on the sheets. And then we couldn't afford the doctor, so we had to have grandma and grandmother and grand aunt and sister and cousin come and collect this baby and birth this baby as grand midwife. These were untrained, unskilled women, as they say, but they were the ones that were the backbones of allowing us to have 14, 15, 18, 20 children at home, getting up and going back out to the field. So it was strength in numbers. And we didn't have to have epidurals and C-sections. And we were having 12 and 14 children, and we were having twins and triplets and all of them at home. And what happened to that? It happened when the integration came in, when we thought what they were doing was right. What proved that was Henrietta Lack, and that's a whole other topic of discussion. But when they proved that our genetic countenance was greater than theirs, therein lies another thing. You done created mass hysteria, because you now have created all these people thinking that it's going to help your bottom line. You now create all these people that are now superior beings.
Medically
we
superior.
Have the dominant trait. Exactly. Yes. We have the dominant trait. I know all of the people look at, you know, light skin, long hair, and green eyes, and they think, oh, that's pretty. Those are recessive traits. Those
Thank
are
you.
Broken traits. Those right. are not things that we look at as, we see it as beauty, but what we're seeing is broken beauty.
Yes.
And we have to get out of that mindset. So I'm bridging that into understanding that when we tenet that, and we tenet that piece in the understanding of where we're going, where we've been, we will understand where we're going. So the ideology and the mindset has to change. My husband is actually a cognitive restructurist, and not to toot his horn, but he gets in there in that post-traumatic slave syndrome mindset, and we get into that, and we bring back the fact that there was a woman in my community called Ms. White. She used to sit out on the porch every day, rain, sleet, snow, or hail, and watch us go from the bus stop to the house and make sure we got home from school all right. She would do this every night. Either she sat in the window when it was raining, or she sat on the step when it was sunny and nice. Either way, she would watch all of us, and she would have a pen and paper next to the phone with all the phone numbers on there. And if you didn't do what you should, your parents got a phone call. Now, you know, when you got home, you didn't get beat for doing what you did. You got beat because Ms. White called. You got beat because Ms. White interrupted their job to tell them something about something you should have done better. So what we miss and what we are missing from that is the understanding of how strong we are, and then the Miss Whites in the families or in the community. I used to hate Miss White. I used to always say, I wish she would just die. I just wish somebody would just hit her with a car and just kill her. Why? Because I didn't like the fact that she was actually loving me. But if for the sake of the retribution that I knew I was going to get if Miss White caught me going to somebody else's house after school. So I hated her. I hated her for years. Now that I'm grown and have children and grandchildren of my own, I miss Miss White. I miss that mindset of taking care of everybody, sitting at the feet of the elders, understanding that the elders have been here just a couple of days longer than we have, and maybe we need to listen to what they've been through so we're less likely to repeat it. So in understanding that the matriarchal head, there are no big mamas anymore. Grandmama is 35. Great-grandmama is 50. So if you even count, from 1865, when slavery was abolished, till now, that's 153 years. I think that's the math. It's about 153 years. That's since slavery was abolished. So if you work out the math on that, and again, bear with me, that's about 8.5 generations.
Right.
So that means 8.5 people. That's your grandmother 7 times removed. That's how far back we have come, and that's how far we've gone. But what we were doing 7 generations ago, 8 generations ago, is far different than what we're doing now. There is no respect for elders. Elders are now a torrid piece of lack of help. Like, in other words, we got to do something with grandmama. What you mean you got to do something with grandmama? Well, we got to put her in a home. We put her in a home? What you going to put her in a home? Black folks don't put their parents in a home. White folks do.
Right.
And I hate to say that in the terms of it, but you have to understand that we took care of our own. Now it's okay for us to put grandma and great-grandmother in dementia care home.
Yeah, what happened to that nurture?
What happened to that is that we left from, remember back in the day, and I know all of us can relate, remember back in the day when someone would walk up to you and be like, aren't you Miss Jones, boy? Aren't you one of the Johnsons? Girl, you look like the Sicily from around the corner. Aren't you Miss Black's child? And you're looking at them like, oh, Lord, she know my grandmother. Lord. So you knew you couldn't cut up. You knew you couldn't do anything. You knew that was going to get back to her. So you used to represent the Johnsons, the Blacks, the Jones. Now you represent your hood. Now I'm from Compton. Now I'm from West L.A. Now I'm from, and it's like, are you serious? What happened to Miss Johnson, Miss Black, Miss Jones? What happened to representing your family? What happened to keeping a good head for your family and representing the lineage that you came from? That's because the lineage that you came from has forgotten. You can't teach something you don't know. And if you don't know where you come from, you can't possibly give your children that history lesson.
Mm-hmm.
So why is it that we're losing this? Because we're so busy keeping up with the trends and the social media and the fact that you have to ask someone to be your friend. What happened to that? We used to go outside and make friends. Now you got to request them. We used to ask people to connect with us. Now we got to request a connection on LinkedIn. Are you serious?
Right.
Networking was ringing a doorbell and coming by and tapping on your neighbor because you ain't seen them in a long time. Now we got to go through text messages. That has become absurd.
So with this whole era that we've been ushered into, social media and not really building community or whatever, and we're missing that nurturing, that community nurturing element that exists in Ms. Hollis's time, are you finding that when you're talking about reparation, I could say it earlier. But anyway, when you're talking about that and you're trying to get people to understand the plight, particularly of men who are incarcerated, how do you get those who don't get it to corral around your efforts?
You make it real to them. If that means that you have to bring in family and friends and people that they're close to and use them as an example. Case in point, I work with the women that are pregnant and incarcerated now, currently, and I deal with the pregnancy and keeping the jails accustomed to doing the things that they need, for health and well-being of the baby and the mother. And one of the things that I mention to them is when the mothers are having their babies, the one thing that they can do now is breastfeed, and they have pumps and everything. But the breast milk has to be delivered to the baby outside of the jail. So one of the things that I say to the mothers is, whoever comes up here to visit you has to bring a picture or two of the new baby. Even if it's a week ago, you just had the baby and it's the picture's a week old, every time somebody comes up to visit you, they have to bring a picture. And that picture of that baby is a reminder, a current reminder of what she is coming home to. And in return for that, the mother must either write an email or write a letter or do something to that child at that age. And what does that do? That builds legacy. Because from the day that the child was born to the day that the child gets to see those letters, or I say now, even since you're talking about social media, is set up an email account for the child and then just start writing emails to them. Well,
yeah.
If you're incarcerated, you can't do that. So what I say is they write the letter, they mail it to the custodial person that has the baby now that, you know, she's incarcerated, and now they put it in a photo album or they scan it into email. And what that does is that sets up a lineage so that the child will know that my mother was doing this. This worked
right.
eons ago. This was our written language. This is how we came to where we are now when we weren't able to write. We had stories to
right.
told, the folklore.
Right.
So now this is telling another story. This is telling the story of how I felt, where I was, and what I was
mm-hmm.
thinking about. That also allows the mother to see where she is.
20 right.
years from now,
right.
she can look back
yeah.
on that and be like, God, I was messed up. Oh, my
Absolutely.
God, I was messed up. But you make it real, and you get these mothers to understand what they are doing to their child. The fact that you have to write a letter to a child means you're not with them. So it makes it real for them. I got to get out
right.
of here. I can't keep writing these letters and hoping for these pictures. And then what happens if the person don't come on that next week for their visit? Now she don't get a picture. So does that discourage
okay.
her from writing a letter? No, it shouldn't. But does it? Yes. So we got to make
right.
it real. You don't get a picture if you don't write that letter.
Okay.
So this
okay.
makes it real, and it brings it home to them. So these are that's just one example. Of course, there's many, but that's the piece that I always hold on to as far as making it real and making it real time.
Awesome. That reminds me of another similar program where mothers are reading. There's a tape of their voices reading a book.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. That's given to the child, no matter how old that child is, so that child
right.
grows up with the voice of their mother even while
that's
she's
right.
incarcerated. So let's
that's
stop
right.
here. We're going to have another commercial break, and then we'll come back. Listening audience, if you have a desire to call in and join the conversation, you can do so by calling 347-539-5285. Again, 347-539-5285. With break for commercial.
The Dr. Maxine Bryant Show. Tune in. www.blogtalkradio.com. Gumbo for the soul. To listen to the lively conversations that are relevant, dynamic, and inspiring on the Dr. Maxine Bryant Show. The first segment, Groove Talk, is dedicated to uplifting listeners and engaging them in life-changing conversations that can help move them forward with their weekly tasks. The second segment, When Is My Debt Paid?, focuses on challenges and successes of released prisoners as they reintegrate into society. The Dr. Maxine Bryant Show.
Okay, so as we're talking about increasing the awareness as it relates to mass incarceration and recidivism, I want to go back to Ms. Hollis for a moment. I want you to think back to when you were arrested and coming back out. Were you received as a hero?
Thank you for asking that question.
Okay.
Thank you for asking that question. What we did at that time, actually, our part in the event was so well planned that we did not invoke the harsh violence. And that's a whole nother story. But
mm-hmm.
because we were arrested, the young people from Jackson State and the community rallied around the jail to protest, and that's when the violence erupted.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the history of Mississippi, the sit-in was the first real success in opening the doors in a place where it made a big difference for all of the communities and all of the citizens. But we had to endure the stigma of the violence when we did get out of jail. Basically, I didn't feel anyways as though I'd done anything really big. And I remember that day I felt pretty much a little bit down because there wasn't anything said positive about it. And there was just so much going on, and it was a lot of negativities. The young people who did try to rally around us, they were actually put out of school. They were suspended from Jackson State, yes. And
let me interrupt you. Why were they put out of school?
Because this is not the Tougaloo Nine. This is the ones from Jackson State College. They were put out because they were there with a rally to support what we did. And they brought out the community, and this was something that Mississippi would not tolerate. And the police and everybody were very up against this, and there became violence because they didn't want you to speak out. And the young people did not just stand there. They wanted to speak out. So the police brought the dogs and the billy clubs and all of these things out. And, of course, real violence ensued. So that was a problem. And I think for me, I was happy that I had made a difference, happy that I had opened that door and that we had these things to our credit. But it took some years to heal from that. It was some time for me to heal because, and that's why I thought about it when you asked that question, how did I feel? I was not anyways really happy about it. And the things that happened to me and most of the nine, we have all of our stories. Not everyone finished at Tougaloo. I was one of the three four that did graduate from Tougaloo. So, yes, and we have a lot of history and a lot of stories about that, and it took a lot of years for us to get this story out. In fact, that's why I continue to speak and talk to people, because many of the Tougaloo Nine still cannot talk about it in any public arena. And
help us understand that. What's that about?
Well, there were things that happened to us. For instance, just on my case, I was denied a job. I was not received. My resumes were not received when I did graduate from Tougaloo with my all of my support, my degree. I had a major and two minors, and I had already done my student teaching and everything, but I was not received or welcomed to work in the area that I lived in and across the state. So the only place that I was able to get a job within that next year was almost Alabama, which was in Meridian. So, and probably the only reason that I got that job was because of the things that I had on my resume that made it really easy for me to be received, because I had not only physical education and dance, but math and biological sciences. So I had a lot to offer for a person that would hire me. So I think that's what opened the doors for me. But many had to leave and go back to their states. Some of them had to escape the area and even to go all the way to the north, some back to their homes in the north. There was two that were a senior the next year, and they graduated, and I finished in the next year. So it was difficult. Most of the fellows, the youngest one, I think, Albert did finish up, and one of the young men had to escape and go to the north. So we had some difficulties. And the main thing that when we did come together as pretty much the largest group, it was 45 years later. And at that time, we all talked about it. and we pondered why wasn't what we did opened and made a difference. You see, overshadowed from our event was the Jackson sit-in. Overshadowing that was the bus ride, the Freedom Riders. So everything that really you heard about was all about violence, and that's not what we did. When we made the effort to open the library, we planned it, we worked with it, we did it in a very intellectual way, and we had a lot of good support and planning. And so that sort of took all of the importance from it, because nobody really understood what we had done because of all the violence that followed. However, over the years, we have made a big difference, because here lately we did get acknowledged for what we did in the planning. And we, I understood just last year that libraries, all of the libraries in Mississippi were open the very next year.
Right.
And, of course, everyone knows that Meg Evers was our mentor and NAACP leader, and he was killed in the very next year.
Right.
So
right.
All of that had a big, made a big difference in what was being done and said. And so our story goes to what we did and who did it, who were a part of it, and why we did that. And, of course, we were looking at the law and the constitutional laws and about the integration, the Brown versus Brown Act and all of those things. And so those things were still coming up through others who came behind us. And the state of Mississippi, we found out that they really did not want to integrate the schools. So after the library was integrated, then it took about, it was 1968, I believe, when they started integrating. Now, I know that there is a lot of negativity about the integration and people moving out of the communities. And that wasn't because of the integration itself. That would have been great had the people really wanted to pull things together. You see, it was the mentality of the administrations, because administrations, they did it in a way that they wanted to keep all of the whites in charge. It was the same type of thing. You had good teachers, some of the same good teachers who were put in the white schools or whatever, but they had to deal with all of the fallout of being in those areas and not having the autonomy that they had in the black schools, but they were still good teachers. And I'm saying that because I still have family that is down there. I still have friends that live down there. And so I know even now you have blacks in every area. They have really blended everything, especially in Mississippi, the parts that I know of. And you have administrators. You have teachers, you have people in all of those areas, and they are being able to work with all of the students. But you still have that core amount of people who still have that mentality. And so that has been the hardest thing. And what is happening in the last year, and especially this last year, is because when you have those ideologies and you see a person that's supposed to be a leader come in and he's through all of the things that you're trying to overcome, then people are going to be more adamant about the things that they don't want to see. And so we can see those little particles coming through even in the educational facilities and schools right now. I'm seeing that from people that I know that are some great teachers, and they are still having some problems pulling some things together. And it's because of people's resistance, because they still have that old mentality. However, I do say that because I've been in touch with most of the people that makes a difference in the library system and things like that, that there has been a great change.
Okay.
And I wrote in 2012, when I wrote my first book, that there was a 180-degree change in Mississippi for the citizens there. and especially in the town where I lived and in Jackson, Mississippi. So I can see that, and I want people to know that. And it's because when we learned about the things that we could do, and I would say, yes, in myself in trying to get some of those things changed, I had to go in and really talk with some of those people and ask them, why is it that we are not getting these things? And I have seen them move on those.
Okay. One of the things that I found out or discovered in my research about Tuvalu 9 was that the library, after you all did the read-in, one of the reasons that it was decided that it would desegregate and allow African-American children in was to become a part of the bigger fight to keep schools from becoming integrated. Were you aware of that?
Yes.
Had you ever heard that?
Yes, that's what I learned. That's why they integrated the library systems, so that they would not have to deal with the school systems. And that's why I brought out the point that it was in 1968 that they really just went ahead and integrated the school systems. But they held out, and they did not fight the libraries, because the libraries were one of the public facilities that they really knew that everybody could just, no matter what the age or whatever. So they integrated that, and they were opened.
Okay.
Yes.
Good. Thank you for educating us about that, because I never knew how you all were received afterwards. So what's interesting is that the denial of employment and other opportunities that you faced then as a result of standing up for your rights is in many ways similar to what people coming out of prison after having paid their debt are being faced with when they try to get employment or when they want to get involved in programs or need to get involved in programs that assist with housing or food stamps or aid for education, your student loans, all of that. Those doors are closed on them because of their involvement with criminal activity, even though they have done their time. So with that said, I want to, were you going to say something?
I was just agreeing with you, yes. That does happen, yes.
I want to transition back to Dr. Ali and talk about this, the importance of this 529 prepaid college fund. So has that already been created?
Oh, yes. The 529 prepaid college fund was started actually in the 90s, but it wasn't brought to the forefront until after the housing market slump in 2008. So that tells you how long they kind of kept this secret and quiet. And that was methodical and intentional. And what that meant was for those that were deciding that they were going to start putting some money away makes me believe that the housing crunch was preempted. This is saying that they knew it was going to happen, and they were trying to set people up so that they wouldn't be in more of a dire strait than normal. Who has time to pay for a child's college education when your house is in about to go up or you're about to lose it? So what they did is they enacted the act quietly, and they put it into formation. And they allowed the legislature to quietly amend the Constitution to add it and allow it in the Reformation Act. And then they allowed it to pass in both houses so that it would become law, like, overnight. So they sat quiet with it, put it on the shelf, and kind of said, okay, it's ready. And they sent it to, and this was actually an allegation in a federal court when they started bringing this forward, that they sat it on the shelf and hand-delivered it to those that they felt was worthy of it. So now they were able to put money away, and they were only allowing certain people to be able to do it. That allowed the commodity to be higher and the demand to be greater because there's only a few people involved in it. So what they did is they allowed it to go untapped. And then they decided, oh, well, since nobody's really doing it, we might as well do away with it. Well, the folks that had the money already vested in it, it's like the stock fund. If they take the stock away, you lose all that money. There is no insurance on that. So they were like, oh,
right.
No. So now what they said is we're going to take that money and we're going to put it toward our kids' college, because that's one thing that if nothing ever happens, you know, in the house, we'll be able to take care of our kids' college and keep everything looking apropos, even if it's not. And, you know, they're big on keeping it looking like it is, everything is all right. And then, you know, in the background, things are falling apart.
Course.
But that helped us, because now
right.
that it's in place, they have securities in place. One, you can't lose the money that you invested. So whatever you put into it, you will get back, even if the stock goes down, the commodities go down, or the interest rate goes down. You still will get your capital that is there. So if you got 18 years of doing this and you have it saved up, oh, my goodness, yes. I will make sure the government is saying this. I will make sure that at least you'll have that to come back to you. So the fathers don't really lose anything, and until the children
right.
use it for school, it's actually sitting in a savings account. And that's pretty much what it is. They can't tap
right.
into it. Say again.
Now, I was just going to say what I love about it, and, you know, just in case the general community does not know this or is not aware, the fathers are using monies that are coming from their commissary. So, like, instead of spending their money that's on their books on commissary, that money is going into this 529 prepaid college fund. And you identify three advantages to this to the prepaid college fund. One, obviously, is what you just said. It helps to finance the child's education. Two, it eases the taxpayer's burden. We understand that. That's an easy one, I think. But you also tie it to recidivism. Can you explain that for our audience?
This is bread and butter. This is what they allowed for me to speak at in Congress for, because they wanted to hear how I was going to keep the men out of jail. And you know that's a faux pas for them. They want to keep them
right.
in jail. So now they want to. So I didn't give them my full hand. I gave, as my grandmother say, I only gave you three fingers on my five fingers. So so I didn't give them my whole hand. But what it does is, when men, as you mentioned earlier in the show, this was actually in the beginning of it, when you brought me in, you said that men are, the clock doesn't start, the clock starts when the mother goes and sets her claim for child support. If the father's
right.
in jail, he still is owing this money. Now, what happens is the man, you know, let's say he commits a crime and it's, I don't know, 2 years. Now he's been in jail 2 years. Now he has to come home. He has 2 years of child support that is in arrears now. It's no longer just owed. It's in arrears. And in arrears, in the state of Georgia, I know, and in New York, if it's in arrears, it's a criminal offense. So if you're
right.
on probation or parole and they say don't break the law and you're in arrears, that's a criminal offense. So
right.
So what they're saying is they're going to make it hard for you to get a job to actually pay it. And then they're making it a criminal offense now that it's in arrears. So you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. And now
right.
that you're on probation and parole, the scale is heightened a little, because now they're watching everything you do, to include the fact that you don't have arrears. So what they do is they wait for you to come out. They give you about 48 to 72 hours to taste the fresh air, get reacquainted with the family, and then they knock on your door, and they
yeah.
say, we have a warrant for your arrest for non-payment of child support.
So, isn't that great?
Yeah, exactly. So now, and they wait, and it's been statistically proven that they will wait. Now, most people, if they're coming out of jail, and anybody knows that comes out of prison, they have, it's called HOLDS, H-O-L-D-S. And it's called any wants and warrants that are on you. And they actually check before you're actually released. So the day you are released, they're going through wants and warrants and see if there's anything with your name on it. Now, if you've been in arrears for 2 years, your name is on a warrant.
Right.
So why is it that they release you from jail?
Hello.
And then only to turn around and arrest you. Why? Because they have to release you based on the time that you already served, because
right.
you committed that time to society. They have to legally release you. However,
right.
unless the charge is in front, unless it's like something like another county wants you or something like that, they have to literally release you for 48 hours. So they wait until 72, right when you're good and comfortable, and knock on your door.
Mm-hmm.
So when they knock on your door, where you're supposed to be home, especially if you're on home monitoring, they're going to knock on your door and they're going to say, we have a warrant for your arrest. Now what it makes it look like is you couldn't keep up the terms of your probation parole. So what that does is that throws you back. Now, you're not getting arrested for the prior crime. You're just on parole from the prior crime. You finished your term. You're just on parole. But what it looks like is if you finish and you're not on probation and parole and get rearrested, it is now called habitual. You just got out. And you get rearrested
right.
again. So now the state says, man, you can't get it right if you wanted to. So now that's the second strike. Well, with this program, for the 2 years that you're incarcerated, even before you get out on probation and parole, you put 2 years' worth of money away.
Right.
So now you're no longer in arrears. Awesome. If anything, you may be behind, but you're not in arrears.
Right.
Yeah, you may not be able to pay $700-$800, but just like with child support, if you pay something, it is accredited. Now your money is just behind. You're not in arrears. You just owe this amount of money. So they have to take what you give them, and they have to account for it in the arrearage package, but they cannot call it arrears if you're paying something on it. Just like your phone bill and your electric bill, if you pay something on it and you're paying it down, they cannot harm you or hurt you. That's the Fair Credit Law Reporting or something like that. Can't remember the wording. But if you're paying on your bill, they cannot send you to collection if you're paying something on your bill. Same thing with child support.
Awesome.
Federal mandate said they cannot put you in an arrears status, taking away your license or your driver's license or your passport. They cannot garnish your passport or violate your license if you are paying something on it. So that causes them to be able for the next 2 years, even if it's $10, $20. No, I think the minimum is $25. So even if it's $25, they're putting away every month, they're putting something on it. So what the measure is saying is that if this enacts in Congress, we can add that as an alternative measure for them to pay child support to a government-funded source, just like child support, and allow it to pay over time. So there is no difference between what they're doing now and what they're going to be doing on the prepaid college fund.
Okay.
And the child wins. So there is no recidivism because they won't go back to jail. There is no time away from the child as far as, you know, the DFACS, the Department of Family and Children's Services, the one that mandates when you can see the child and supervise visitation. There is no mandate because you've been supporting the child, so there is no reason for them to take the child away from you. There is no I can't see the child until you pay such and such amount because you've been paying. So there is no reason for that father to be away from that child except for his desire not to be in the life of the child. He can't say, oh, the mother held me back or what. No, because the court says if you're paying child support, you have a right to see the child. So now you get all your rights reinstated. Now you're a convicted felon, but you have rights under the laws of you paying child support. So who loses? Who loses?
I know, right? So now one last question for you, and then I want to get to Ms. Hollis. But is that national or is it just in Georgia, the 529?
Well, here's where we're pushing it, and I'm actually working with Diane Sears. She made me a Atlanta coordinator for the International Men's Day. And with her voice in doing it internationally, I'm hoping to take the charter from Georgia, make it a proclamation for the state, and when you make it a proclamation, of course, it's a federal notification, and then take it to D.C. So my goal is this time next year, I'm going to use all of 2018 to fight this here in Georgia. And I say fight because they're already looking at me crazy because they're thinking, why are you defending men, one? The women are looking at me crazy because they're saying that's going to take money. The women are trying to support their children. But really what they're doing is they're supporting their Mercedes-Benz and their house notes with the money that's supposed to be going towards the children. And that's what I was finding also, which upset me to no end. And then I was looking at women that really, really need the money, they're not getting it. And they're not getting it from the men that are necessary to get it from. So now they can. So hopefully we're making it a nationwide effort within the next 2 to 3 years.
Okay. Real quick, Ms. Hollis, tell us about the 57th anniversary of the Troubadour 9 next month. What are you doing?
Oh, right now, thank you. Right now we are trying to get all of the Troubadour 9 on a show on the 1st. I'm working with getting them, and we're going to be co-hosted by Michael O'Brien, who wrote the book We Shall Not Be Moved, who's going to work with us on that. And so far I have several of the Troubadour 9 who will be able to be on the program with us, and hopefully we will also be able to do another program along with that one in the month of March. March the 27th marks the 57th year of our event, and yes, we want to celebrate.
Awesome, awesome. I'm glad that that you're doing that. It's time for us to sign off for the show. Thank you all for listening. You've been listening to Incarcerated Lives Matter 2.
Thank you.
Brought to you by
Thank
Tribe
you.
Family Channel, a Gumbo for the Soul International Family Brand. I am your moderator, Dr. Maxine L. Bryant. The show is produced by Beverly Black and co-produced by Diane Sears. We have had the honor of talking to Dr. Amina Ali and Ms. Geraldine Hollis from Tupelo 9. Have a good day.
Thank you so much, Queens. This has been a very profound and ripe show full of information. I just wanted to sign off with a testimony. I am Beverly Black, and I am celebrating today 26 years crack free because I was arrested on this day, Incarcerated Lives Matter 2, and I was arrested walking into bondage and being set free and praising him. And so I'm praising him yet another day, another year. So 26 years today, and I'm encouraging you all, do not give up on anyone. You have no idea what is inside of that person. Had anyone given up on me, we wouldn't have Tribe Family Channel. We wouldn't have Gumbo for the Soul Publications. We would not have these books out of me. I would not have found who I am. So please do not give up on anyone that you know that is incarcerated, and thank you so very much for tuning in to this phenomenal show. God bless you.
We celebrate you, Dr. Miss Beverly Queen. Wonderful.
God bless you. God bless you, Dr. Maxine Bryant. God bless you, Mrs. Geraldine Hollis. God bless you, Dr. Amina Ali, and peace be with you. Here we go.
Bye-bye.
Just like a bird, I just want to fly free and own a piece of land somewhere off in a country. Oh, hey, listen. Temperatures like 100 degrees. I got chains for me, blackmail in the family tree. Been proud of my destiny. Reckon I'll fly away, cause it's too much for the man. Shouldn't have gone down this way. What happened to my master plan? Cause I can't figure out, I could have been a love child. Shouldn't have gone down this way. Tell me, how did I get lost? Oh, yeah.
Life.
Talk to me.
Life.
Oh,
oh.
How did I get lost? Tell me, yeah.
Life.
Oh, yeah.
Life.
Oh, somebody done me wrong. Done me wrong.
I hope for
that all.
Dr. Maxine Bryant Show. Tune in, www.blogtalkradio.com, Gumbo for the Soul, to listen to the lively conversations that are relevant, dynamic, and inspiring on the Dr. Maxine Bryant Show. The first segment, Groove Talk, is dedicated to uplifting listeners and engaging them in life-changing conversations that can help move them forward with their weekly tasks. The second segment, When Is My Debt Paid?, focuses on challenges and successes of released prisoners as they reintegrate into society. The Dr. Maxine Bryant Show.